Welcome back this afternoon. I hope the engagement party was successful, if I'm remembering that correctly. And we just have one case this afternoon. And let's go ahead and get started. If counsel are ready, this is Sorensen versus Polakoff, case number 184120. Mr. Sturba.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And may it please the court, good afternoon. In the George case, which we cited in our brief, the court indicated you don't need to be omniscient with respect to 9B particularity when it comes to fraud. Certainly, you need to give fair notice to the defendant of what it is the conduct that you're complaining about, and that's the purpose for the particularity of 9B. Moreover, the court in that case and also in the Safe Streets case basically indicated that where there are perhaps deficiencies in terms of the access that you have to information that may be with respect to the other side, the courts maybe look at the pleading a little bit different, a little bit relaxed standard with respect to 9B because you don't have the information and therefore you can't plead it. We have that precise situation here in this case, as I will explain further. The lower court erred in respect to particularity in 9B as it interrelates with our wire fraud predicate act and our mail fraud predicate act by essentially going down the road of only focusing on the wire transmissions and the mailings for purposes of ascertaining particularity with respect to fraud. That was an error. Moreover, by doing that, the decision is devoid of any analysis of the other allegations in the complaint, which all go to the furtherance of the scheme to defraud and have other allegations which are relevant and material as to particularity in terms of 9B. Let me address first the circumstances of the wire transmissions and the mailings. We cited Zander, we cited Schmuck, we cited Redcorn. Redcorn's a wire fraud case, but essentially the fact that a mailing or wire transmission in and of itself is not fraudulent is of no moment with respect to the analysis of whether you've adequately pled a mail fraud or a wire fraud. In fact, it could be a totally innocent transmission. Many times it is, many times it isn't. Now, certainly with respect to fraud, you can look at the transmissions and you can look at the mailings to ascertain particularity, which is what Judge Stewart did. However, he stopped there. And to that extent, he committed error because the analysis was if you don't have the particularity requirements of 9B in the wire transmissions or the mailings, then somehow you have deficiently pled those, and therefore he determined they were not adequately predicate acts. What he didn't do, though, and is not in the opinion, is there are allegations contained in paragraphs 45 through 59. Which contain not only, as I count them, five different attributes of a false statement, but moreover, there's concealment behavior and dishonest behavior, which is adequate for purposes of mail or wire fraud as it relates to the transmission component or the mailing component or the fraud component.
What are the fraudulent representations in the ads?
Well, in the ad itself, Your Honor, first of all, they attribute to Dr. Sorensen specifically that he basically dummied up, essentially, medical records by upgrading or upcoding or what have you, what was going on. Instead of describing something as a headache or something like that, he described it as a stroke or TIA, which is a more serious medical condition, for purposes of deceiving insurance companies. Secondly, they said that the source said this Dr. X, actually where their holes were not existent in the chamber of the heart to implant the device, he actually put a hole in the heart chamber to implant the device.
Those are all in the ads?
Pardon me?
Those are all in the ads?
Yes. I'm looking this sort of the second paragraph linear here. Down at the bottom it says, Dr. X became more brazen. On multiple occasions, the source claims to have seen Dr. X deliberately punch out and enlarge otherwise clinically insignificant holes in the heart of patients, only to close the holes by using the expensive and permanently implanted closure device. That's the second false statement. The third one has relates to the fact that they're talking about other physicians, that is, radiologists, people who are doing MRIs and other things, who are skewing their results, presumably in some way to participate with what they're alleging Dr. Sorensen is doing that's fraudulent, so that he can use that data or those medical records to use the diagnosis that he wants so that he can implant a device. That's also in this particular ad. And finally, they talk about the American Medical Association guidelines. They talk about FDA guidelines. The American Medical Association has no guidelines. The FDA does not issue guidelines. It actually deals with devices, and to the extent that it says things about devices, it does, but it doesn't have anything to do with guidelines with respect to this particular matter at this particular time. And finally, it's just an interesting thing to note. This is our theory of the case, that is, there was a solicitation using the data off the hard drive for purposes of accessing potential clients to file medical malpractice suits. It indicates here that a third party, because of laws, i.e. HIPAA, can't contact the patients directly for purposes of warning them, presumably, about this nefarious behavior by Dr. Sorensen. Well, the fact of the matter is, that's exactly what we're saying happened, so I would suggest that's a false statement as well. So that's at least five.
How would you precisely articulate the scheme to defraud?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. It starts with Dr. Polakoff being employed for a very short period of time pursuant to a contract with the clinic. He then goes and deceptively and conceals what he's doing from Dr. Sorensen, gets with the technical company of the business, and basically...
Those are what happened. What's the scheme?
The scheme is to basically monetize the data on the hard drive
and to obtain it properly. How are they doing that?
By now sending out solicitation letters, which we attached one to the complaint, to basically have the data, they have the patient's name, they have the presumably the procedure, they have other information, they send out solicitation letters.
They're defrauding the potential plaintiff class?
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Who are they defrauding then? The potential plaintiffs?
Well,
how does that defraud?
They have defrauded Dr. Sorensen because they didn't acquire the hard drive properly or correctly or honestly.
No, that's theft.
Okay. Well, it also can be an act with respect to a mail fraud or wire fraud. If in link to the behavior you have mailings and or wire transmissions, which A, are fraudulent, or B, part of the scheme to defraud. And without the solicitation letters or without the advertisements...
You're losing me. How are you going to monetize the data that was stolen, as you've alleged?
Okay. Let me give you an example. Send out a solicitation letter. You don't know who the patient is. You now do because you have this data.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Send out a solicitation letter that says what it says. That is, there's an issue about the procedure. We think this has value. In fact, we refer to a solicitation letter that talks about $100,000. If there's no demonstrable injury, your case may be worth. Therefore, contact us. That's how you monetize the data on the hard drive. But
won't that have to be proved to a jury? I mean, you send out a solicitation order or letter, they sign up for your services, you don't get anything until you come into a courtroom here and the jury says you get something. And the only way the jury's going to say that is if it's true what is alleged against Dr. Sorensen.
Two things to that, Judge, and you're right in a sense what you say. That's why we didn't plead it as showing monetary damage relating to lawsuits, because it's not a concrete injury unless and until there's a resolution. And we think all these lawsuits are frivolous, and ultimately there'll be potentially damage associated with that. But moreover, HIPAA does not allow for a lawyer to take HIPAA-protected information and send out letters soliciting clients.
So there's a wrong. That doesn't make a fraudulent scheme, though.
Well, if the scheme is to basically acquire data and then to use that data to generate business, and then to try to monetize that business into presumably settlements or other kinds of adjudications, that is, in fact, a scheme and artifice to defraud. And remember, the start of this was Dr. Polakoff's dishonesty vis-a-vis Sorensen, representations to the tech company which were false, representations to Dr. Sorensen, which were false. And so that's how it started. And then it went from there to the access of the hard drive, the use of the information, sending out solicitation letters, and now you have 22, at least right now, lawsuits in Third District Court as a result of that. That was the purpose of trying to obtain that. I will try to, here's an analogy, maybe a poor one, but doing the best I can. If somebody needs a special ingredient or a special commercial product, a commercial copyright or something, and it's in a safe, they go and they for whatever reason, dishonestly access the safe to get actually what's in there because it has monetary value. That's what happened here. The hard drive with the data had monetary value that they thought it had because they valued it at least $100,000 per client. So that is what is going on, and that's what they were trying to ascertain. And that's the scheme, and look at it this way, to obtain the data, steal the hard drive, solicit the patients, and try to monetize the results. That's the scheme. And whether they were effective or not, for example, if the lawsuits all end up being dismissed, or there's no adjudication of wrongdoing by Dr. Sorensen, under general mail fraud and wire fraud jurisprudence, doesn't matter. What you're punishing is the scheme and artifice based upon false statements, falsehoods, false representations, and deception and concealment. That's exactly what we've pled here. And remember, we're at the 12B6 stage, so that's what's pled.
So who has received false and fraudulent statements in this case?
I would say, Your Honor, the recipient of this ad.
So how did they get a false and fraudulent statement?
Well, if they read the ad.
This is the 6 points that you mentioned when you started your argument. Those are the 6 false things, and the recipient of the false things, the victims, are those people who read them and sent in their names as potential plaintiffs.
No, I would suggest that Dr. Sorensen is one of the victims for sure, because absent the data and absent the hard drive, this wouldn't even occur.
But they didn't use the data or the hard drive, as I understand it, to send out the ads. Those were public. They just sent them out. And so did they use the data on the hard drive to decide who to solicit? I thought it was they only responded to people that themselves responded to a public announcement.
Let me see if I can clarify. I hope I can. We have one letter, and it's the only one we have because it's the only one we have. It's a direct solicitation of a person in no relationship to the lawyer or anything else. It's just a letter saying what it says. It's soliciting that person as a client. The only place that could have come from was the data on the hard drive. The ad and the other representations are all part and parcel of the scheme to defraud. It's just like any mail fraud or wire fraud case. There are a whole series of potential falsehoods, concealments, misrepresentations that are part of the scheme that all go into it. And that's what we've alleged here. And I see my time is close to up, so unless anybody has any questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Greg Brown. I represent Appalese, which consists of Dr. Polakoff, who, as the court knows, is a relator and plaintiff in an ongoing False Claims Act that this court decided last year, as well as various lawyers and law firms that represent him.
I understand what Mr. Sturba said was that there was one letter in the files, and one letter only, that was a direct solicitation of somebody that could have only come from the information on the hard drive. Is that correct or not correct?
The pleading has one letter. That is correct. The fundamental conflict is at one moment they think people were fraudulently solicited via advertisements. Another, it's from the hard drive. So they don't identify a single person in 2 versions of the complaint solicited either way, and whether it be newspaper, Facebook, whether it be the Zabriskie Law Firm webpage, whether it be through mail, no person is identified. Counsel started the argument by saying, well, that's just information we don't know. A well-settled principle of this court is a plaintiff alleging fraud must know his claim when he files it. And one of the things is the district court cited not only the general 9B standard, but the for mail and wire fraud, the Bonk, Oklahoma case, as well as Tal v. Hogan, which cites that case on 508 of the opinion. Four of those elements are the recipient, and there's no single recipient identified as having relied on, read, been solicited by any of the advertisements or mailings. And Your Honor asked, what is the scheme and artifice to defraud? They said it is using the information from the hard drive to fraudulently solicit patients, former patients, to file medical malpractice, as well as information to be used in the KETAM. Now, that's on, you know, paragraph 100 of the amended complaint. So the court may ask, well, where's the fraud? It's either in the mailings and in the advertisements themselves, or it's something about these lawsuits. But the answer is the same, that there is no allegations of well-pled allegations of fraud in either one. So if we take each predicate act, the mail fraud, they actually...
Well, they allege that Dr. Sorensen punched the hole in the heart for some of the procedures, right? And he's alleges that that's false. Why isn't that a good enough false representation in the advertisements?
Several reasons. First of all, the notion that Dr. Sorensen was named or attributed, he wasn't named. The court can see from himself in the amended complaint for both the mailings and the advertisements, he was not named. Second of all, that comes directly from the KETAM amended complaint that Dr. Polakoff had, you know, the ongoing KETAM that this court remanded. That's simply an advertisement stating, well, I heard of Dr. X and I had this evidence. His opinion of why it's false, and quite frankly, there's no factual allegations to support that opinion, don't establish 9B, especially from one advertisement in the newspaper in which he cannot demonstrate anybody that relied on it, anybody that signed up for a malpractice lawsuit through the actual newspaper, and when they would have seen it, how the representation was material. There are no allegations to support any of those facts. As far as the letter itself, similarly, the throughout the amended complaint, if the letter is the basis for the claim, at paragraph 86, the Zabriskie law firm continued to send letters to Dr. Sorensen's asserting that Dr. Sorensen performed unnecessary PFO closures. That's the record at 27. In furtherance of the scheme, as hereafter alleged, the defendants were and are still using the internet and U.S. mail. But the briefs tell a different story. He said, well, the district court erred by looking at the mailings and the advertisements themselves. But that is actually what appellant provided to the district court and relied on for his entire scheme. So the fraud has to be there somewhere. It's either in the mail.
That's not quite right, is it? It isn't the complaint about the district court that the district court required that the mailing or the wire itself had fraudulent misrepresentations. And the district court did do that, and that was erroneous, was it not? Or do you not concede that point?
No, I do not concede that point.
Well, do you have any law that says that that is the law of our circuit? Because I know there are cases that certainly I read to say that otherwise.
Well, for instance, the Tal versus Hogan case, as well as, let me take a step back. The district court's actual ruling for both mail and wire fraud was plaintiff's amended complaint fails to plead with particularity that a scheme to defraud by false pretenses, representations, or promises exists. So yes, the district court goes on to analyze both the mailings and the advertisements. However, the ruling is not so narrow to say that's the only thing I'm looking at. No other scheme was articulated or provided as to, let's just say, the medical malpractice lawsuits, that's the fraud. Well, who signed up? What's fraudulent about those lawsuits other than he thinks they're frivolous? If any defendant can just say, well, it's a frivolous lawsuit, that's a fraud, that cannot be the standard.
But this is a motion to dismiss. We're at 12b6, so we take the representations as true, and if you take all of the representations, what we just heard, that's not enough?
No, because even if you assume his opinion that the lawsuits are frivolous or meritless, that's simply the contents. That is not the who, the consequences of being induced or to sign up for these lawsuits. He can't name a single person. He doesn't even know if solicitation happened. And in fact, he says the 22 people that have filed lawsuits against him, upon information and belief, those people were solicited, assuming that every single plaintiff has signed up via solicitation. That does not come anywhere close to meeting 9B. That is him simply taking every person that has publicly filed a case and making the leap, well, they must have been solicited.
But you're on notice. You know who he's talking about, and there's no big surprise there. It's just that he hasn't been able to tie that loop with discovery yet, right?
In terms of us being on notice, I don't dispute that we represent certain people. We certainly dispute the manner in which he says people were illegally solicited via the hard drive, yes. But we're not disputing that we represent former patients. I would agree with that. But in terms of saying some patient relied upon a solicitation letter and it was improper in some way and then they were fraudulently induced, yes, we certainly dispute that. And we don't think we have any such notice of anybody who was solicited or improperly solicited in any such manner. In terms of the other cases he cited, the George case even has a holding saying, well, people receive, you know, fraudulent and misleading statements in the mail. That's not enough. That's the same thing here. He's simply saying, oh, well, I think there's thousands of letters. We need some discovery. And we need some discovery is the precise holding in Farlow that this court said, no, you have to know your claim when you file it. And Farlow dealt with the same situation about mail fraud. Well, just saying this general allegations, well, I think there was some fraudulent statements. The court there said, no, we're not going to allow this kind of fishing expedition in to make your claim. You have to know it when you file it. So in terms of the actual art briefs, he's saying, well, the district court erred by looking at the mailings. Well, this court has had cases in RICO where the courts have looked at mailings periodically because that's what's provided as the basis for a mail fraud claim and as the basis for a wire fraud claim. Including, you know, as far as the wire fraud goes, there's obviously the newspaper advertisement we talked about. He also says the defendants put the Zabriskie Law Firm's website as of May 8th, 2018. That's when he filed the amended complaint. So he's going back to the Zabriskie Law Firm website, putting a date and saying, well, that satisfies 9B. That is not what 9B is. It's not only simply, you know, the who, the contents, the consequences, the reliance. He's just putting in a date and saying, well, I've met 9B because I put a date in there.
What about on the transportation claim of the hard drive? How did that get from Utah to Texas? And why doesn't the transportation of stolen property claim survive?
A couple of reasons, Your Honor. The first of all is they did not respond to our arguments and cases when we filed the renewed motion to dismiss. If you actually look at their opposition brief at 475 to 476, they just simply recycle the claims, and that's just word for word from the statute. So what the district court held was is there are no well-pled allegations of the value of the hard drive as $5,000 or more. He's simply taken the text of 2314 and 2315 and said, well, I've got this claim. But first of all, in his complaint, he says 76 to 77, that Fleming Nolan and Jez and Rand Nolan transported the patient information to Utah. And that's exactly what we say U.S. v. Brown and the Dowling case from the Supreme Court foreclose, because he's saying it's the information going from one state to another. But even if you took his argument that the information can contribute to the value, there are equally no well-pled allegations of the value of any patient information.
Why wouldn't taking the hard drive be enough?
What's that?
Why wouldn't taking the hard drive be sufficient? And distinguish it from Brown.
If the hard drive itself, well, first of all, in no way does he have any well-put facts that this implicates interstate commerce at all. He's just saying a hard drive was stolen and it went to one law firm for another. He has no well-put facts about the make, the model, where he got it, when it crossed the state lines.
Well,
his allegation...
We have notice pleadings. You don't have to do make and model number, I don't think.
Well, I think at minimum you have to go beyond just conclusory allegations of copying and pasting the statute. He says before December 4th, 2015, which is when Dr. Polakoff filed the amended complaint, he says all of the allegations regarding the what he alleges to be the theft happened in 2011. So he's saying somewhere in those 4 years, the hard drive crossed state lines. And I would also note that he actually states Dr. Polakoff did what he believes to be a theft of the hard drive, and then he says, and then the law firm defendants entered the picture. So he's trying to backdate what he alleges is Dr. Polakoff's theft, as that is a RICO predicate act applicable to the entire group of appellees. So for several reasons...
I thought his claim was that they delivered the computer to the law firm, which crossed state lines. There's intellectual property on a hard drive that goes from Utah to Texas. Why doesn't that get you over the motion to dismiss stage?
Because, Your Honor, he says the scheme is the acquisition of the stolen hard drive in which the other appellees have, there's no well-pled facts that any of them had any involvement. And I'll also note for that matter, as a matter of public record, the law firm defendants did not represent him when the key TAM was filed under seal in December of 2012. So he wants to say that 4 years later, when Rand Nolan and Fleming Nolan and Jez filed an amended complaint, I can tie this dot to that dot and allege a RICO scheme. And the scheme and artifice to defraud is using the information on the hard drive, which he says is monetized for a defendant's financial benefit. Well, there's no well-put allegations of that either. There's no well-put allegations that there's any basis to the key TAM of how that's being done, when the amended complaint in fact redacts any inpatient information, as well as the malpractice cases, which he believes are frivolous or meritless, but that doesn't make it fraudulent. So I realize we also have several alternative arguments. I don't know if the court wants to address any of them specifically. But I will note that even if you accepted a lot of these allegations as true, this is not a pattern of racketeering activity. A pattern of racketeering activity requires the threat of continued criminal conduct. For this court to find that, this court would have to rule that Dr. Polakoff's pursuit of the key TAM, in which the government intervened in the appeal, constitutes a long-term threat, as well as the law firm defendant's representation, the former patients in the state court, that comprises continued threat of criminal activity. That just can't be the case. The False Claims Act is, of course, meant to recover monies on behalf of the government. That's the whole point. As well as the representation of clients, that's simply a typical legal service that cannot be a threat of continued criminal activity. I would also note we have several other arguments regarding there's no enterprise or injury pled, and I see that my time's almost up. If the court has any questions.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your argument.
And thank you for accommodating my schedule. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Judge Phillips, I have, I think it's Zander right here. They quote Schmuck. Schmuck's Supreme Court case, I think Justice Thomas was the judge, says right here, in affirming these convictions, this is referring to Schmuck, the Supreme Court rejected the defendant's argument that a mail fraud conviction cannot be based on routine mailings that are innocent in themselves. And that's the law. Zander, Schmuck, Redcorn, that's the law. Brown is an important case because we had four predicate acts. We had well, actually probably more. We had the mail fraud, the wire fraud, mail fraud 2314 and 2315 dealing with the receipt of stolen property and the transportation of stolen property. And the court below decided on Brown that they were not adequately pled. But actually, if you look at footnote 14 in Brown and actually look at the language of Brown, it's true that if you just have data that's basically intellectual property in and of itself, it may not satisfy as a good. So therefore, under the, I think it's the National Stolen Crime Act, it wouldn't be sufficient. However, we have a hard drive, which is a good, and when you can join that with data, you get there. Footnote 14 says it expressly in Brown. Moreover, valuation, what the court didn't address is it's 10,000 digital patient records on that hard drive, which I think reasonable inferences that took quite an effort to get there. Two, it's got value in and of itself. That is to say, Dr. Sorensen, professor at the University of Utah, research, what have you, that data alone can be very important for purposes of research. And finally, they value each patient, theoretically, at $100,000 apiece. So that data alone obviously has value based upon the allegations in the complaint. So I'll submit it. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate the arguments this afternoon. You're excused. Case shall be submitted. And court's in recess till tomorrow morning at 9:00.